This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 276 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. I'd like to start out introducing my co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening to everybody. And I'm not even going to talk about you-know-what tonight because it's too cold in Chicago to talk about that.
David Vanderhoof is also joining us from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, folks, happy 50th anniversary to Doctor Who, and Rob and I have been celebrating all weekend, so it's been a good weekend, and I got to wait another 50 years to have this much excitement in my sci-fi geekdom.
And if you're not a Doctor Who fan, well, you can always change.
That's right. Our guest, now we can ask our guest, Max Trescott. Max is an author and, I guess, flight instructor extraordinaire. He also writes the Trends Aloft blog. Max Trescott, welcome back to the show.
Hello, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. I guess I'll leave now. No, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me back.
Now, you're not a Doctor Who fan as well, are you?
You know, interestingly, I had it on earlier today for one of the first times I was looking at one of the reruns because I know that that's always a major topic with Rob.
I was hoping I'd have some company in the don't care about Doctor Who category, but I guess it's just me. Ah, well. All right, we're going to have a little bit of a different sort of format in some regards this episode. We're just going to have a sort of extended conversation about some of the news topics, some of the listener mail with Max, other Max. But as I mentioned, we've got some aviation news we're going to talk about, all kinds of things going on in the world of aviation this past week. Dave has also got an airplane of the week for us, I'm sure. David, what are we looking at this time?
I'm going to be quiet and you're just going to have to listen, but I'm taking the clause number one to the history segment, which means it's my segment and I'll write what I want to. Okay. So it's one of those episodes.
All right. Well, we'll find out what that is coming up. We've hopefully got an Australia desk report. I'll be honest with all of you guys. We're recording actually 24 hours earlier than normal. So we haven't received an Australia desk report as of this moment. Hopefully we will, and we will insert it later.
Let's talk about it anyway, though.
We could do that.
We heard it, and then we can tell Stephen Grant that we either really, really loved it or we just panned it.
All right. We can do that. Peter Johnson has brought us an Across the Pond segment. He talks to the editor-in-chief of a Polish aerospace website about military procurement, also the state of the Polish legacy carrier LOT lot. And as I mentioned, we're going to try to tackle as much of the listener mail as we can get to this episode. And we've got some great things from you all, our great listeners, so we're all looking forward to that. All right, well, let's start off with some aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Let's talk turkey.
All right, we'll start off with the Dubai Air Show. And we have a number of articles on that show, which seems like it's becoming quite the show for commercial aviation anyway this year. We had Boeing launching the 777X officially at the Dubai Air Show. Some massive, massive orders for both Boeing and Airbus. I think together they represented about $175 billion at list. All the prices that we mentioned, these order volumes are always at list price, which sometimes doesn't always bear a direct resemblance to the actual prices paid, but it's kind of the yardstick that you can use. Boeing on the 777X has 259 orders and commitments for that as of this air show. 150 of those are for Emirates. Also announced 50 for Qatar Airways, 25 for Etihad, and there was a previously announced order of 34 from Lufthansa. That's more than $95 billion worth of 777Xs. Pretty good out of the gate.
Yeah, well, if you like the 777X.
It's a beautiful jet.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know what I thought was interesting is I found a story related to the Dubai show, or actually to this this Qatar Emirates deal. I can't even remember where I saw it, but the fact that, that Qatar and Emirates got together, they joined forces to negotiate with Boeing for their deals on the 777X. And I'm not the airline expert, but I've never heard of two airlines working together with a manufacturer to get even a better deal on a new airplane. Mm. And as you said, even though these are list prices, I'm sure they got really, really good deals on these. But still, I've never heard of two airlines working together like that to try to get the best deal possible.
Yeah, I don't recall ever hearing about that either. But, you know, those are two big airlines that carry a lot of weight. So I imagine that if they team up, that represents some significant negotiating power. So, well, that's interesting.
And if you look closely, I think most of the orders that came from the show were for airlines in the Middle East, except for maybe a little bit to Lufthansa and that sort of thing. But so, you know, this is where the center of the airline buying universe is right now. And they really set the stage, I think, this time.
Yeah, it is the center. And we saw it also with Airbus and Emirates. A $20 billion order for 50 more Airbus A380s. There was an Aviation Week piece, and they noted that this takes Emirates' total commitment to the A380 program to 140 firm orders. So that's Emirates is by far and away the biggest customer of the A380. In fact, Aviation Week notes that they have almost half of the order book for this type. So, I mean, that's kind of interesting. You know, we look at the A380 and see it as kind of the big flagship model, the big guy. And yet one airline has almost half the order book for it. It's kind of incredible. But still, the volumes on the A380 are not gigantic. And the 777X, I think, is, surpassing that pretty easily.
Well, and I had a chance to attend Dubai a couple of years ago, and 2 years ago, that show was nothing like what these people seem to have experienced this time around. And so I think it really has grown quite a bit. But, you know, something I always wondered about, when you have all those A380s or any of those, I wonder if you get different payment books every month for your 380. That
coupon, huh?
748 million payments left on your airplane and then it's all paid off, or maybe it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, interesting. The financing terms, that's something that you're never going to see in the press. That's just not generally publicly available. And I'm sure that there are instances where actually the financing arrangements are pretty creative. They may not be equal monthly installments. There may be different ways to handle that, but that's all kind of part of the mystery and magic of selling commercial airplanes. We also saw that Bombardier made a little bit of headway. A little bit. They received orders for 5 C series worth $387 million from Iraqi Airways and 11 options. So Bombardier came in and helped nudge the total close to $200 billion for the air show overall. Yeah, it's a big event. I don't know that the order volumes will be able to be sustained at this level, but it'll be interesting to see what happens next time at the Dubai Air Show.
You're absolutely right.
All right. One final interesting note, then we'll move on, is I saw one of the articles, and we'll put links in the show notes to several of these articles if you want to kind of get an overview and see what some of the action was that took place at this air show. But one comment was that relating to sort of the way that this region is growing is that 80% of the world's population lies within 8 to 10 hours flying time from Dubai and Abu Dhabi. Interesting. So the fact that they're emerging as a global hub is not surprising. All right, our next item. This is actually an article by Max Trescott. The future of general aviation is you, so get cracking. And I'll just sort of kick this off, Max, and then turn it over to you. But we've talked about the pilot population and how it continues to decline in the United States. It's not true in all the other countries. Some it is, some it isn't. But Max says that maybe pilots can do something about this problem.
Yeah, I think a lot of pilots have looked to the alphabet organizations, EAA and AOPA, in the past to try and solve the problem. And I think the reality is that they're facing some shrinking budgets. They can't do everything. And this might not necessarily be the top priority for them. And so I think that perhaps, you know, some type of grassroots approach where pilots say, you know what, it's up to us to go out and find other pilots and help solve this problem. And it might be an approach that has some merit.
Yeah, but do you think they'll do it?
Well, it's like anything else. You know, some will, some won't. You know, I think the thing in the back of my mind I was thinking about, you know, the Tea Party, and I don't want to talk about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, to some extent there's a grassroots element, and to some extent they've had some impact. And I just wonder, could pilots organize in a way to do something similar? You know, is this important enough to pilots to say, we care enough about the future of aviation that we're going to go ahead and focus on this as an issue, and we'll start actively seeking out people that we think should, you know, get a pilot's license and become part of aviation? My feeling about this is that a lot of people looking at the outside in at aviation almost view it as a kind of a club, kind of something that, you know, that is kind of mysterious, difficult to understand and pierce the veil and really know how to become part of it. And I think it's just important for pilots to actively go out, identify, you know, friends and acquaintances of theirs who might be a good candidate, and invite them to join the club. I think, you know, we need to just do more outreach, get more people to try aviation, and then steer them toward flight schools and flight instructors.
And it's not like an effort like that on the part of pilots is some big effort that's going to put you out, right? It can be a very simple thing.
Well, sure. People like to fly, and often there's a seat empty in the airplane. Why not bring somebody along? You know, flying alone, I find pretty boring compared to having other people in the airplane. And I suspect a lot of pilots, you know, don't find other people to fly with them or don't actively seek them out. But if we had a goal or a program, you know, maybe we need a catchy name. You know, it's the pilot pledge or something. And I pledge to find a pilot to replace myself in the pilot population, and just start filling those right seats with friends and neighbors. And, you know, anybody you think might be a reasonably good candidate.
You know, and I think another, I remember too, this was probably 10 years ago, maybe 15, the mentor program that AOPA had. I don't know, is that still running, Max? Do you know?
I think it is, and I was thinking about it because I submitted a name to that back in the 96, I think. I had just changed job locations, and I know I took that job in 96, and shortly after that, one of the folks there found out I was a pilot, and he said, hey, I'm interested, so I submitted his name to the program. I found him a flight instructor. I took him for a flight, and you know, he had his license probably within a year, and we ended up being partners, you know, in a Cessna 210 some years later. So, you know, from a personal experience, I've seen that it works.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, getting people up off their duff is sometimes tough, but it is interesting, the piece that you mentioned, or that fact you mentioned in your blog post about the fact that in Europe, which we always think of as, oh, way worse than here, that it's actually getting better, and that's something I don't think we've seen the bottom yet, and part of the reason I agree with you is that, you know, the people that really have the chance to affect change, which is all of us, even if it was just one body recommending one body, I mean, we just haven't been doing that.
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy these days with the internet for people to kind of feel like, well, if I post a comment to an article, I've helped solve the problem. And I really, you know, part of the reason I added, you know, the so get cracking to the end of it was just to kind of, as a call to action. It's like, nah, don't just read this and post a comment and be like, oh yeah, I've done my job. You know, that's not what's going to get it done. You know, what's getting it done is, you know, picking up the phone, calling folks and asking if they want to go for a ride with you.
Let me ask you this. What happens if the number of pilots continues to decline? If we have fewer and fewer and fewer pilots in the United States, people learning to fly, what's the downside of that?
Well, I think the downside is that as certainly organizations like EAA and AOPA are going to have fewer members, and eventually when they, you know, try and influence Congress, they're going to have fewer, you know, people to say that they've got behind them, and we may have less influence in Congress and find it more difficult to protect aviation against intrusive regulations or taxes and things like that. So I think any group that is going to be strong in our country needs to be growing just to maintain its presence. And if you're, if you're a shrinking population in a growing country, you're going to have a smaller voice. And I think that voice is pretty important to protect what we have.
All right, let's move on to the next item. We had some, this is stirring up a lot of controversy and comments and so forth. We have something called a federal air surgeon who happens to be Dr. Fred Tilton. And he's notified air medical examiners that soon they'll be required to measure body mass index, BMI, of all pilots and controllers during their medicals. Now, body mass index, let's sort of baseline people on this. It's the requirement is for people with a body mass index greater than 40 and a neck size greater than 17 inches to be tested.
I did a test on that. I was up at the Center for Disease Control has a...
Yes.
A scale, and I tried it, and because I'm 5'10", and I said, well, how heavy would I have to be at 5'10" in order to have a body mass index of 40? And I figured out I'd have to be 285 pounds in order to have a BMI of 40.
And 40's pretty high.
Yeah, well, and for people that know me, I mean, I weigh 163, so that would be like two of me. So we're talking about some people that are significantly overweight, but that's not the whole story, is it?
No, and what they're looking for is obstructive sleep apnea. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention says that body mass index is a number that's calculated from a person's weight and height, and also that it provides a reliable indicator of body fatness for most people. It's used to screen for weight categories that may lead to health problems. And as Rob mentioned, the CDC has a BMI calculator in there. You put in your height, you put in your weight, tells you what your body mass index is. So they're looking for those greater than 40 and a neck size greater than 17 inches. Well, why 17 inches? So I took a look over at the Mayo Clinic to learn more about obstructive sleep apnea. And the Mayo Clinic says that occurs when your throat muscles intermittently relax and block your airway during sleep, and that the most noticeable sign of obstructive sleep apnea exactly is snoring. So, well, why do we care about snoring? Well, we don't really care about snoring, but the Mayo Clinic says that certain factors can put you at increased risk, including being overweight, having a large neck, high blood pressure, and a couple of other things, and that obstructive sleep apnea is considered a serious medical condition, and complications can include cardiovascular problems, daytime fatigue, and some other things. So why is the government interested in pilots and controllers who have this sleep apnea? Why do they care?
I can speak from experience, having someone in the household who was diagnosed with it. If you're not careful and you're not sleeping at night, you can fall asleep at the wheel or the console or the stick. That's the biggest concern, is basically either that or the risk of a heart attack that comes with sleep apnea.
So both the EAA and AOPA and lots of other people have voiced serious problems with this. The EAA and AOPA have sent letters to the government saying that there's no evidence to suggest that sleep apnea is any kind of a problem for pilots. It's not part of the FAA's charge to protect the flying public on health issues and things like that. Why are people so excited about this?
I think they're excited. You know, again, if you hang out with pilots, most of the ones that I've known over the years tend to be fairly conservative people. And they don't like the government telling them what to do. So, you know, again, if someone had said at FAA that we have research that we believe will show that people with sleep apnea or that have a BMI of whatever the baseline is are more apt to have sleep apnea, and that these things, some of which David mentioned, could happen, and we're really worried about that. What do you guys think? And they put it out in an NPRM or some other public forum, I think you'd have gotten a lot of the same kind of conversation that we're having now with people saying, well, I don't believe it. It's my right to be overweight if I want, or whatever. But it's the fact that they seem to have just decided, as Dr. Tilton said in his editorial that I wrote about too this week, that we're just going to implement this. And that's what is making people nuts. There was no opportunity for anyone to even voice an opinion about this. It's just going to happen the way it's headed right now.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's absolutely the issue. If they had had public comment so that people could kind of review it and chew it and discuss it and, you know, make suggestions, that would be one thing. But I think this really rubs people the wrong way to just have it tossed out. I posted something about this on Facebook a few days ago, and I think we had like 29 comments. It was incredible, the number of people that responded to one short little post. And it was about evenly split. There were folks who said, hey, this is a serious issue, and either I've experienced or other people have experienced. And, you know, the other half said, hey, this is really pretty invasive. We don't want the FAA telling us that we need to do this. Probably the most interesting one came from an AME who said the real question is, you know, should the FAA be involved in preventative health care as opposed to regulatory medicine, where there's a kind of a clear mandate for them to be involved with that? You know, that and the fact that apparently there have never been any aircraft accidents attributed to this kind of raises the question of, you know, is this really, you know, that important? I also think there's a camel's nose under the tent aspect of it as well. You know, they've talked about BMI of 40, but one of the articles said that after they take care of those pilots, then they'll be down to 30 BMI. And you just kind of wonder, okay, where is this all going to end?
Yeah, some of the reports do suggest that this mandate's only a starting point, that the end game is really to have everyone tested, and that they're just, you know, kind of starting at the high end of the scale.
But if sleep apnea is directly related to fatigue, isn't fatigue suddenly on the FAA's radar, given the current crises with pilots and lack of sleep can cause sleep apnea, which causes lack of sleep? So, I mean, if fatigue is an issue that all of you guys have talked about, why wouldn't you want the FAA to be trying to prevent all sorts of issues with fatigue?
Well, you made a very, very important point, I think, David. I mean, from a practical standpoint, we should absolutely care about those things. But what Max West... That's what we're calling Max Trescott today. He's Max West. Sounds like a spy.
Yeah, we had this conversation before the show to decide how are we going to differentiate between the Maxes. And Rob came up with the idea, since Max Trescott is on the West Coast and Max Flight is on the East Coast, that we'd have Max West and Max East.
Just don't say that Max has gone west. That I don't want to get that.
we don't want to say that. But again, I think that what Max West was saying is that, you know, is this the camel's nose under the tent? Because just like the FAA used to have this mandate of regulating and promoting aviation, they decided they couldn't do both. And so now are they simply regulating health of aviators, or are they taking a more proactive approach? And I personally really wouldn't care so much if they, but let's talk about that, because I'm sure that whenever you change any kind of a direction like that right in midstream, there are pros and cons to the whole thing. And if you really care about that, then at least let us have our say about it, good, bad, or otherwise. And again, I think that's what people are really upset about, is that whether you believe in the right or the wrong of the health side, nobody even had a chance to comment on it.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the cost aspect as well. I think it was the EAA's article said that there eventually 125,000 pilots roughly would come under this this new mandate, and they were estimating sleep studies at $3,500 a piece. You know, you do the math, that's $437 million. And, you know, pilots have been complaining about the price of avgas. I mean, wait till I start complaining about the price of sleep studies.
Well, how much power does the federal air surgeon have? I mean, that's a position I'm not really familiar with at all. Can he just create these mandates and that's it? Or
that's a great question. I don't know of any, at least that I can remember, a previous time where a federal air surgeon has come down with a mandate like this that has never seen the light of day. Other than, oh, by the way, here it is, guys. Get used to it. Doesn't mean it's never happened. I've just not remembered one, but I think FAA is going to end up in court on this one.
Yeah, because I'm trying to think, yeah, what happens next?
Well, you wondered, is the next step that they're going to ban, you know, sugary drinks, or we, you know, can't have a big gulp or something like that? You know, you really kind of wonder, where does it end when you start looking at preventative medicine?
Yeah.
Let's face it, I can't ever get my pilot's license again because of my diabetes, but it's under control and I can drive a car. I mean, yeah. from a medical standpoint, where do you draw the line?
Well, and that's another good point, because there are, forget the sleep apnea aspect of this for a minute. Look at people, mostly men, that have had heart attacks or have had shunts and all kinds of other things. And FAA makes these people jump through hoops in order to get their medical back. And so, you know, this is hardly an exact science, I think, but the fact that it really affects so few people is why so many of us don't seem to really know a whole lot about the federal air surgeon, other than when we fail a medical. But as I forgot who just mentioned that 125,000 figure, I mean, that is really going to put a dent in the topic we were talking about just earlier, which is the pilot population. Because if you have somebody that does this recreationally or has a small airplane they just fly for fun, and now they're going to have to go through an evaluation that's so expensive that's not covered by healthcare, they may just, you know, that could be the tipping point at which they say, you know, it's not worth it.
Right.
Besides, all the flight surgeons editorial said was they were going to have to be referred to a board certified sleep specialist and for evaluation. But nobody defined what evaluation is. Does that mean that the sleep specialist is simply going to look at the records and make a decision, or is it the full-blown sleep study? And, you know, right now, I don't know that this is going to be helping us a whole lot. And then there are the professional pilot side folks that depend on their medical for their living. And so they're really upset about this.
Yeah, when I looked at the Mayo Clinic website on obstructive sleep apnea, I looked for how is this tested? And maybe David can kind of fill in on this as well. But it was a little bit vague, but, you know, kind of by necessity, I think. It mentioned that testing can include an examination, some measurements, and depending on what the medical professional wants to do, even an overnight observation. And that's probably where it starts to get expensive, when you've got that overnight stay where I guess they monitor you during the course of your sleep cycle.
Well, I had one of those. I don't know. Did any of you guys ever have one?
No.
Well, my wife did. I mean, the answer is, and it's not just one, Max. If you have one, what happened was they put you to sleep. You go in and they put you. Now, I don't know how anyone can sleep attached to a gazillion electrodes comfortably anyway, but they sleep. And then my wife actually got a CPAP machine, which helps her breathe at night. And she had to go back and do the sleep study again with the CPAP machine to make sure it was working properly. So that's two nights of your life, and the cost of that. Luckily, it was covered by healthcare. And then you got to buy the CPAP machine, and it's a sizable expense if you get diagnosed with this and you want to treat it properly. A lot of people go through the sleep study and say, I'm not ever dealing with this again. And from a medical standpoint, it's a very severe thing if you get diagnosed with it, and it can be sort of life-changing.
Well, not to mention the fact that once an FAA examiner says, you meet the criteria, it's not just going to be a matter of, well, we really think you need to go talk to somebody about this because we're worried about you. You're done. You are finished. You are grounded until this gets resolved. And in those cases, as I mentioned earlier, about people that have had heart issues that were resolved, or even look at David's mention of being a diabetic, but now it's under control. Oh, sorry. That's just the way it is. See, it's that black and white. We're in charge and we're telling you how it's going to be. Forget the science. And that, of course, is just adding insult to injury, I think, is that the other physicians that I've seen around that have been commenting on this said that, you know, this BMI is hardly a foolproof method of determining anything. It is barely a guideline and nothing more than that. And so again, there's nothing that FAA seems to be offering in terms of medical science or research or anything that says, oh, we know that if these people have this, this is what's going to happen, and this is why we're dealing with it. So again, I think they're going to end up in court myself.
Well, and I think given a choice, they usually pick the more conservative of the alternatives. And I'm sure the thinking is that if anything ever happened where, gosh, God forbid, an airline pilot crashed and it was found that he had sleep apnea, you know, they would probably get crucified for not having done something about it. So given the choice, I'm sure they always come down on the more conservative side. And the issue is how many people you knock out of the game who shouldn't be knocked out of the game as pilots because you're being so ultra conservative.
All right. Well, there's another government agency that's getting ready to stir things up, or maybe already has. And we see that the FCC, the United States Federal Communications Commission, says that it's going to reconsider a ban on cell phones on planes.
I think this is a non-story. I mean, I have never seen any more unanimity for a topic. I mean, all of the major networks, everybody and their brother said, no, we do not want to sit next to some guy on a cell phone for an eight-hour flight. I mean, the FAA may approve it, but I know a lot of the airlines are saying they may approve it, but we're not going to let it happen.
So let's break this down into two components, sort of the technology reason that why you might not want to allow this, and sort of the social reason why you might not want to. But on the technology side, and I think maybe we've mentioned this in the past, but the problem is that, as I think most people know, when you make a cell call, or what we in the United States call a cell phone call, the signal is getting handed off as you move past tower to tower to tower to tower. And that when you're driving your car at 60 or 70 or however fast you drive on the highway, the system can handle those handoffs at that kind of speed. But when you're screaming overhead in an airliner at a significantly faster speed, the system has problems with those handoffs because you're traveling so fast. So that's the reason why the communication companies don't like the idea of cell phone calls from airplanes. What the FCC is saying is that let's look at a different way to approach it. Let's, in effect, make the airplane a cell tower, and everyone on the plane who might be doing this, might be using their smartphone, their cell phone, to either to talk to people or to do under their data plan, would be connected to the airplane, and so that you wouldn't have the handoff problem. And, I mean, that solves the technological problem. But it still leaves the social problem of who wants to sit next to a bunch of clowns yakking on the phone.
Well, the other social problem is what kind of, you know, disruption and violence you're going to start having in the airplane. I just can imagine fights starting over, you know, someone who's being inconsiderate with their cell phone. It just, I think it's going to be a disaster for, you know, flight attendants to have to manage an unruly cabin because of, you know, this kind of distraction.
Yeah, that could be very messy. And I mean, we know what happens when tempers flare on flights. It can turn into a very bad situation very quickly.
Well, look at how many times before the airplane even departs, when we're all sitting in our seats and you have the freedom to use your phone, how many of us have been on an airplane where you can hear some woman or man 11 rows back talking on their cell phone as if talking louder would help the person in Seattle hear them better? And all you can think of is, oh, please, can we just shut the door so they can turn that stupid phone off? Because you don't have a minute's peace. And it's almost a bit like the size debate they've had with people that can't fit in a standard seat and say, well, you know, I can't help it. I bought a seat. And someone next to them says, yeah, well, so did I. And you don't get to have some of mine in order to make you fit. I'm sorry you are the size you are, but go sit somewhere else. And I agree with Max, though, that, you know, people these days, I don't care whether they're on airplanes or anyplace else, they're often not terribly considerate when they're traveling. And I think if this gets going, you are going to see stuff happen like we haven't even thought of yet.
It's not like it's needed either. I mean, everybody's connected on wireless internet on the airplane anyway, so people are totally in communication while they're on the airplane, and at least they're not disturbing people when they're using their laptop. So I think it's totally unnecessary.
So what got this started? I mean, I know they're doing it in Europe, and they're considering it, but I mean, if you're going to try to do this in the States, wouldn't you as an airline say, well, wait a minute, before we spend the money to try to outfit all these airplanes, which we haven't even put Wi-Fi on yet, don't we kind of need a business case that people really want this?
And, I think you're right. I think it is the money. Who do you think will make the money on this?
Well, sure, but somebody's got to invest the money first. And yeah. I
bet the airlines are looking at this as one more fee to add on. Oh, the cell phone fee. You know, they'll probably charge you a certain amount of money to use your cell phone, and even more if you don't want other people to use it on the plane.
No, I think Max, I have to disagree with you. Delta and some of the other airlines already said they don't want this. I really think that they consider this the ultimate. This is the one fee that I think they just would rather not have to get. You know, if it does go live, they're gonna have to charge for it, but I think they would rather not have the option to charge for something, because I think there were frequent flyers on the news and various interviews saying that, you know what, if my airline that I fly on a regular basis allows this, I'm gonna change airlines.
Well, you know, to that point, David, this is a point that Mary Kirby made, and I just discovered this just today. Mary has a new project, which isn't fully rolled out yet, that's called RunwayGirlNetwork.com. And if you go to RunwayGirlNetwork.com now, she has a few posts, but that's all. One of them is titled, In-Flight Voice Call Debate is Red Herring. What Mary is saying is that if they were to do this, if they were to implement this technology, that it would be up to the airline to decide if they wanted to allow voice calls or not. And that's something that they could basically turn on or off just by throwing a switch separate from data. So they could keep data on and they could keep voice calls under this technology off if they wanted to. And so if the FCC said, you guys can do it, use this technology, and it's up to you to do it if you want, then those airlines, this is what Mary's saying, those airlines that don't want to have voice calls occurring in their cabins can just turn the feature off. And if an airline says, no, we're gonna market ourselves as the airlines, you can fly and yak on to your heart's content, then the consumer could say, well, you know, that's what I want to do, I'm flying with them, or that's exactly what I don't want to do, and so I'm going to take my business elsewhere. So I thought that was an interesting perspective from Mary Kirby.
I think cell phones is really the new smoking. I mean, do you remember, it wasn't that many years ago when it was just insufferable in the airplane law? I mean, I can remember just feeling terrible sitting one row away from the smoking area and going, you got to be kidding me. I'm sitting here breathing all this stuff because there's a sign between me and the guy behind me. You know, people really felt very strongly about, you know, smoking, and, you know, something happened on that. To me, this is the smoking issue again, all over again.
The analogy might be pretty good. And most airlines, almost all airlines, don't allow smoking. I mean, it's not the airline that disallows it. But there are some airlines where you can smoke. And that's certainly an airline that I would never fly on. Similarly, if an airline allowed cell phones, voice calls, I probably wouldn't fly them either.
No, and I doubt seriously that they're going to get enough revenue from enough people using cell phones to make installing this technology worthwhile. I think they're seeing the return, American, Southwest, Delta, from putting Wi-Fi on, because people like playing with that. You know what? I'm not bothering Max if I'm sitting next to him and I'm playing on Wi-Fi, and the airline's making money. But you're going to put something in. I mean, let's be serious. The airlines are squawking now about having to invest the money for the technology for the next gen ATC system because they don't see a benefit for it. They don't want to do that. So maybe FCC will say, here's the system, or here's the format, or the technology, go for it. But I don't know. I just can't believe these airlines are going to be that stupid. But I guess I could be proven wrong.
So maybe we need to have them install phone booths in the back, you know, that if you want to make a call.
You want a call, go back there.
Somebody did make a comment that they could always, go, using the smoking analogy, make a phone call, make a phone section, you know, where if you want to use your phone and you're, you can sit in that section, pay an extra fee and sit in that section, and then all they got to figure out how to do is how to make it soundproof back there.
Yep.
That's right. I wouldn't care, as long as I don't have to listen to it.
Sure.
Unless they're one row behind you and there's a little sign you that says cell phones not allowed beyond this line.
That's not good enough. All right. Well, again, the FCC has not made a decision. They've only decided to reconsider it. And so we'll watch what happens there. And I'm sure that they will receive lots of input from folks weighing in on their wishes for this. And whether that influences their decision or not, don't know. I don't know if there's any strong, powerful forces behind this pushing the FCC along that we're not aware of.
Well, I think there is actually one that maybe we haven't talked about, the fact that they're kind of going full speed ahead with this in Europe. And I forgot which carrier it is, if it's Lufthansa or someone else, that has already made a note that they're interested in this. And so I think, you know, people have started asking FCC, well, what about us? And, of course, those three people, who cares? We'll buy them an airline ticket, send them on their own airplane.
Okay. Listen to them. All right, let's move on. There's a story coming out, Rob, in AIN Safety. It's not out as we record this, but it's coming out soon. You've been talking about, this is about the Mitsubishi MU2, is it?
Well, it's some of our listeners may not know, except, of course, David and Max and us. We all know about this because we're old guys. But the MU2 is a really fast twin-engine turboprop built in, I think the first one started appearing in the 1970s. But they ended up with kind of a poor safety record. I mean, they're not huge. They carried six, seven people in the back and a couple of people up front. But again, they didn't have the greatest safety record, and eventually what a users group found out was that, you know, they really believed it was the training that these pilots were receiving that was really causing some of the difficulties. And to make a long story short, there's an organization down in down at Addison Airport, Turbine Aircraft Services? Let me just make sure I've got that right.
It is, yep.
It is, Turbine Aircraft Services, that was contracted with by Mitsubishi Heavy Industries to become kind of the focal point to help see if there wasn't something they could do, because there are nearly 300 of these airplanes out there still airworthy around the world. And eventually the FAA passed what was known as a special FAR that said, if you own an MU-2, you must go to an approved school for training and have recurrent training in this airplane so that you don't let the airplane get away from you. And that regulation, I think it went into effect in 2008, and the accident rate just plummeted. I mean, so it appears to have been a really good thing. Well, make a long story short, of course, a week and a half ago, there was a fatal crash of an MU-2, and it just happened to be flown by Perry Inhofe, who was the son of U.S. Senator Jim Inhofe, who's a Republican from Oklahoma. And Perry was killed, and this is the only the second accident I believe they've had in 5 or 6 years since the regulation was passed. When I started talking to people about it, because I was just looking for the story, I wasn't even sure what it was, I found that the training organizations are caught in really in a catch-22 situation. The training that MU-2 instructors must abide by now is listed in this special FAR, which was originally published in a notice of proposed rulemaking, which to us here in the United States means it was in our big fat Federal Register document all the time, and you can't change it. It is what it is. It's law because it's there. Well, and then a year ago, the FAA changed its mind about the way we teach people how to perform stalls, because in the old days we used to just say recover from the stall with minimum altitude loss, and then someone said, maybe that's not the best idea. Maybe we ought to make sure people are really getting the airplane flying again. So they changed the stall procedures, except they can't change the stall procedures that they teach on the MU-2, because it is a part of the special FAR. So everybody that trains knows there's a new stall procedure to be taught, but the people in the MU-2s can't teach anyone because it's in the special FAR, and they can't get FAA to do anything. I mean, Turbine Aircraft Services has been on the FAA for over a year since this thing came to be, and nothing is happening. And so... And now we have this accident. We don't know that it was a stall spin or anything like that, but it has all the markings of it. And it's going to be one of those situations, kind of like what we were talking about before in terms of the sleep apnea issue. Everybody knew this could possibly occur. Now that it has occurred, did it happen because FAA didn't do something it was supposed to have done? Right now, it kind of looks that way, and that's kind of an awful situation.
All right, so Rob, this is going to come out in AIN Safety?
Yeah, it comes out tomorrow, so people can go up there and see it and read all the details, and I'm sure we'll get some hate mail from it or something, but FAA kind of put themselves in the corner on this one, I think.
So anybody have any other interesting news from the past week they wanted to bring up? I'm thinking about you, David.
You mean airplanes landing at the wrong airports? Nope, I don't know anything about that. Max West, did you hear anything about airplanes landing at the wrong airports or anything like that?
I'm sure pilots of large professional aircraft would never do that. That's probably just something that happens in two-seaters.
Well, with the fun one, we were talking about this before, and unfortunately, the poor guys flying the Dreamlifter Atlas Air Pilots contract with that for Boeing, and they kind of missed landing at McConnell Airport in Wichita the other day and landed at Jabara Airport, which is a small GA airport. And the 747 guys kind of got a little lost out there. It was so tight that they couldn't even turn the airplane around once they landed. And it was kind of interesting getting that airplane back out of there again.
Now, this does happen from time to time. And in fact, we were talking before the show. The last one I can remember is the C-17 that landed at the wrong airport. In fact, there's some video of that that we mentioned, which is pretty dramatic to watch the people just, you know, hanging out at the airport, and all of a sudden the C-17 comes in. Well, I think it was probably the same thing with this large expanded 747 that they call the Dreamlifter. This is used to carry components, I guess fuselage and, I don't know, maybe wings as well for the 787. I don't know if there's any video of this. Have you guys seen any of that?
I think it was dark when they landed.
Ah, okay.
It was night. They landed with, but I don't know. I just don't understand how, in this day and age of electronics and all this other stuff, I mean, this is like Air France 447. How does this happen?
Oh, it's five magic words. Cleared for the visual approach.
But were they at night?
Sure. You know, I don't.
I'll bet you that was probably it. I mean, and the trouble is, Max, and I have seen that God knows how many times, you're looking for something in an area that maybe you're not very familiar with, and you see something, and you lock onto it, and you say, oh, there it is, and you're just not going to let any facts get in the way of that whole damn decision. And that, I'll bet you they're going to, because, I mean, I don't know what kind of electronics were involved in this airplane, but this is essentially a 747-400 that they made this Dreamlifter out of, and it's not that old, but hell, you'd have thought that maybe they had their little Garmin stuck to the windshield or something, but anyway.
Well, and there are times when it would have happened, except approach control saves the pilot from making this mistake.
I was visiting
the tower in Reed Hillview Airport in San Jose, which is, what, 3,100 feet long or something like that. And the tower controller said, yeah, sometimes a plane will be headed our way, and NorCal will tell them, oh, you're headed for the wrong airport. So, you know, airline pilots do this frequently as well.
Oh, that's just comforting.
But it does make you wonder what Wichita Approach was doing when they cleared, or I don't know if they would have already turned them over to McConnell Approach or who had jurisdiction at that point, but you'd have thought someone would have said, hey, I think he's going to the wrong airport.
Well, they were able to get this thing up and out of there, weren't they? Even though it was a shorter runway, I guess, than they would normally hope for.
Yeah, my guess is they offloaded a bunch of fuel or something to lighten the load, and I think when they talked about the 9,000-foot runway, that was a gross weight, and I'm sure this airplane was way lighter than that, because when I saw the video, they seemed to get up and off the ground probably in two-thirds of the, was a 6,000-foot runway, I think, so it must have been pretty light. But then those two pilots had some splaining to do when they got back.
Oh, yeah.
So what would happen in that case? Would the pilots typically be severely reprimanded, or what would the penalty be for doing this? Just, you know, sort of a, hey, don't do that again, or would it be more serious than that?
Good question. Maybe it depends on whether or not they came up with a good story like, hey, we were busy working on our laptops and we just didn't notice.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, the company certainly is going to take some kind of action, I'm sure. And FAA is going to take some kind of action against these guys, I'm sure. Well, and guys, I don't know. I don't know that both of the pilots were men, but this is not something they're going to look real kindly on, not to mention all the bad publicity that Atlas got and Boeing got out of this. You know, it was kind of fun when they finally got off the ground. I mean, as I said, I think every TV receiver in the world was watching this thing live, but it wasn't so funny, I'll bet, back at Boeing headquarters here in Chicago.
No, you don't want that kind of publicity, and I'm sure for the pilots, you know, it's a huge, huge major gaffe, and if nothing else, they'll probably make the pilots do a sleep study.
Yeah. Maybe Michael O'Leary will see this as a good idea for an opportunity to get himself in the papers again in the future.
No, did you see that? You know, Michael O'Leary's changing his tune.
He is.
Read that in one of the British papers a couple of weeks ago that they're no longer going to let O'Leary be the spokesman for the airline.
Wow.
They think it's probably time that he needs to shut up, because now the stock price at Ryanair's not quite where it was a few years ago, and they don't want any more bad publicity either. So no more pay toilets.
All right, let's move on now to a little bit of aviation history. We have David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, and he's going to tell us finally what's the airplane of the week.
Thanks, Max. Well, you know, as always, I reserve the right to change the topic. And I was toying with a lot of things, but this week here in the United States, on Thursday, the day after this comes out, we have Thanksgiving. And I'm going to keep this short and sweet, but I think basically being always the, quote, mushy guy on the show, as well as the historian, I'm going to say thank you to all of our listeners, even though a huge majority of our listeners are in other countries around the world that don't celebrate Thanksgiving like we do here in the States. I think I just want to take a few minutes to say thank you, Max. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Steve and Grant. And thank you, everybody else, like Micah and all of the other listeners out there that write to us every week. And we really do appreciate everything you guys do for us and give us the opportunities. And this is a lot of work every week. It's a lot of work for Max. It's some work for me. And it's a lot of work for Rob putting up with the other two of us. So it's fair to say that we really, really do appreciate you, our listeners. And in this week of Thanksgiving, where we spend time with our families who, God bless them, put up with us doing this every week for you guys, I just wanted to take a few minutes and say thank you for everything, and thank you for being the best listeners we could possibly ask for.
Well done, David. Yeah, thank you. Definitely echo David's sentiments.
Well, wait a minute. There is that one guy in Germany that we listen to that calls us every. He's the one guy. He lives in that little town with the big. Okay, well, maybe we don't need to talk about him right now. All right, all the rest of the listeners are astounding.
Absolutely, and keep us going, as David mentions.
But we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't have people that really wanted to listen, and that's why I think, David, you said it better than either of us could, and. I'm glad you did say it, because we do love our listeners. We just don't always say that sometimes.
All right. Thanks again, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 25th of November, 2013. And here we go for take two of this Australia Desk.
Absolutely. Welcome, folks, to the Australia Desk for episode 276. And yes, you're absolutely right, Grant. This is take two. We had some minor technical troubles with take one, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's amazing what happens when your knee gets busted and we have to use the Junior Burger on the other side of the mixing desk while you sit in my usual spot. And Ben Ippolito, ATC Ben, came along to join us and just didn't quite work out, did it?
Yeah, it's a shame, too. And unfortunately, Ben can't join us tonight, so we'll have to get ATC Ben back another time. But yes, let's not talk about my defective knee, which I since found out requires a reconstruction. I'm not a happy camper.
So far, my neck and shoulder don't require surgery, but between the two of us, we've got less than ideal physical circumstances. Hey, mate.
Absolutely. Anyway, this is not the Australian Medical Desk, but let's get on with it. Talking about things that are going wrong, one of the aviation stories that made the news during the last week centers around an Etihad A330 that departed from Brisbane up in Queensland and very quickly decided he needed to turn back. Grant, in fact, as you'll hear from this cockpit audio, he used the M word. Mayday.
Etihad 473. Mayday, mayday, mayday. We would like to request a hold over Bravo Alpha Alpha, Bravo Alpha. We're trying to lose as much as fuel, dump as much as fuel as possible to reduce our weight at 473.
And there we go, Grant. So, yes, an A330, and I hear tell that the instrument failure on board there was, in fact, airspeed indication. You know, just a minor one to lose.
Yeah, not sure if it was the pitot tubes having their problems or some of the computers trying to analyze the results, but, yeah, all indications are that they lost all airspeed. They actually went and did an aborted takeoff at one point. A few skid marks left on the Brisbane runway, came back in. The techs had a look at it, said everything was okay. They took off. Apparently, they were going through 1,000 or 2,000 feet on departure when they lost all airspeed indications again. This is the rumor and information from some of the forums. And basically, they had to go and orbit for a while, dump a whole lot of fuel, and come back in and land all sans airspeed.
And given they had that constraint on their operations, they did a very good job to get that safely back on the ground with all 175 people. And they had to wait a while, of course, and ended up heading off on another flight a bit later on. So I guess, as we always say, Grant, something out of of something bad comes something good. It ended up being a good news story showing the professionalism of those pilots.
Yeah, they certainly managed to land it despite the lack of airspeed. But speaking of professionalism, I'm pretty sure that Virgin Australia is hoping that their lawyers are very professional as they sick them onto the throat of Qantas.
Yes, the Qantas versus Virgin Australia battle just goes on and on and on. You know, it's like the old days, Grant, when it used to be, you know, TAA versus Ansett. It's just the same old thing rehashed. But at the moment, Qantas is not happy with Virgin because they don't think that things are being played on a level playing field. And, you know, it's interesting, Grant, they're encouraging all their staff to get out there on social media and support Qantas and make all sorts of comments, which actually I would have thought would have been, I actually thought that would have been a violation of their company communications policy myself.
Oh, I'm sorry, mate. Was that me going hysterical laughter there at the thought of Qantas management now asking their employees to back them up? I mean, mate, this is, you know, hey, we're sacking a whole lot of you engineering types and we're introducing nastier and horribler situations for you to work in and earning less money for all you cabin crew and some of you pilots. But meanwhile, please come along and sign our petition and tell all your mates to do the same to make sure that Qantas has a better environment than Virgin, because we're really upset that Virgin's able to get a whole lot of money. Yeah, this follows on to what we were discussing last week about Virgin Australia doing a money raising through a rights option through their shares. And yeah, it's causing a bit of a stink. Qantas are, of course, very upset with it. And Alan Joyce is running around going, hey, how can you do that when every time I've tried it hasn't worked, mostly not because of legislation, but because they've sort of done weird things. And including the head of the Australian Shareholders Association, who's saying this isn't really good because it's mostly going to the major airline shareholders as opposed to some of the mum and pop and various other types of retail shareholders.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said last week, Grant, I would never consider myself any sort of expert when it comes to shares and investment and all that sort of stuff. But you know what, I reckon if the Qantas Sale Act wasn't in place, Alan Joyce would be doing very similar things. In fact, as we've mentioned many times before, Grant, if you want to catch a Qantas flight from Australia across to New Zealand, you'll go on a Qantas-looking aircraft that curiously has New Zealand registration. That's because it's run by Jet Connect, which is a New Zealand-based company.
Qantas are doing all that they can to try and make everything go their way. And now the latest with Virgin doing an end run around them and possibly going private, well, Qantas aren't really happy about that. But you know the really weird thing? Once again, I'm feeling that grave disturbance in the force. It hasn't happened for many months. Mm. But the Australian and International Pilots Association are offering their support to Qantas's campaign to change the Sale Act. Who knew?
Oh, that's bizarre.
I know. It's weird. The pilots are in agreement with the management. But, you know, this is the same management who took an airline that has been running continuously for longer than many other airlines in the world and grounded it for a number of days. But anyhow, not to worry. It's all okay. Hop on, sign our petition, join in, and yeah, just ignore the people tweeting madly in the background saying that, are you crazy doing this petition? Because we don't agree with it.
Absolutely. Anyway, let's move on to the wonderful world of defense as we've done the last few weeks and in fact, politics this week. And of course, if you've been following international news, you may have heard that the Indonesian government is not too happy with the Australian government at the moment because according to Mr. Snowden's recently released documents, Australia's spies have been spying on the Indonesian president, and he's so unhappy about this apparently that he suspended all cooperation between the two countries. And from an aviation standpoint, that means that military exercises between the Royal Australian Air Force and the Indonesian Air Force have also been suspended. And Grant, the ABC News this week was getting very excited because the F-16s were departing Darwin and they said they were very noisy. I guess F-16s are not normally noisy, is that right, mate?
No, the F-16s normally have a hush mode.
Oh, really?
They go out quite quietly when they take off. But obviously the Indonesians were very upset with Australia, so they went out as noisily as they possible and turned off hush mode.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know. We were on the floor in hysterics with this one as they tried to make out that they'd, you know, got out loudly to try and annoy the locals. Yeah, guys, come on. An F-16 has two modes, bloody noisy and turned off.
That's exactly right. So that's a bit of a shame. Now, of course, you know, actually suspending those exercises, you know, Grant, we know a few Royal Australian Air Force fighter pilots who might just tell you on the sly that when the last exercises were on, when they brought over their Russian-made aircraft, the Royal Australian Air Force, quote-unquote, smashed them out of the park. So there you go, a little bit of national pride there for Australia. But the other interesting thing, Grant, is that the Australian government, you might remember, has gifted four C-130H aircraft to the Indonesian government. That's been put on hold, and the sale of a further five or six airframes, depending on which article you read, well, that's also been put on hold. So interesting from that standpoint.
all that diplomatic stuff. It's pulling back on the defense side. But you know what's still going perfectly well? Sale of live cattle to Indonesia for turning into tasty, tasty, beefy things. So, while the military get to go home and can't, go out and play with each other and have fun in the air, the cows keep sailing and the beef keeps flowing for Indonesia. So it's very interesting. We'll see how this one goes. But, mate, one other bit on the RAAF front. The C-17 cargo compartment trainer has been commissioned, which allows the RAF to train people in putting loads in and out of a C-17 without using one of the real six aircraft that we already own. Yes, I know I said five last time.
You did say five last week.
I know. I'm sorry. I should have remembered one-sixth. But anyhow, as ATC Ben pointed out the other day when we were trying to record this for the first time, that also means that they can trial putting stuff in and out. And if they stuff it up, well, they don't take out and bend a real aircraft.
Well, that's right, because we haven't got that many of them. We can't afford to be bending our huge fleet of six aircraft.
That's right, mate. Six. Yes, Grant, remember, six, not five. Six. Count of thou not to five, pathest thou to six.
Yes, well, we don't want to bend anything, including my knee at the moment, Grant, because it can't bend at all.
No, exactly, mate, exactly. I'm not sure how you managed to get behind the desk tonight, but congratulations for doing so. Hopefully the levels stay right, and we'll chat to Chris about, dust blinking lights and dust buttons to pushing.
That's right, and I'm going to stick to editing, and I'm going to stop playing basketball. You know, Grant, I'm 42, apparently. My brain just forgot that temporarily. I felt like a 20-year-old again.
Oh, you're 42?
Yeah, now I feel like I'm 142. Anyway, we won't go into that. Well. Could be worse, mate. We could be as old as Rob.
Oh, don't go there, mate. No. Go there. The wrinkles. Oh.
No, the false teeth. The lack of hair. Okay, I think we've stirred the pot enough for this week. We'll be back next week, hopefully one take of the Ozdesk. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer, or what's left of me.
Grant, turn it up to the boil, McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Bye.
I'm off to the surgeon. Oh, God. Oh, dude.
Right, and now it's time for Peter Johnson, Across the Pond.
Today I'm joined by Christoph Kuska, Editor-in-Chief of infolotnicz.pl, the leading news-related web in the Polish aviation market. I've been very excited about bringing Christoph to the show. So Christoph, welcome to Across the Pond.
Hello, nice to hear you.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. We're keen to learn a little bit more about aviation in Poland. Let's start by looking at the military aviation sector. The army is looking for a new helicopter.
Yes, you're right. That's quite a big tender, I think, because not only the army is looking for a new helicopter, but also the navy and the air force. So there are a lot of machines to sell to Poland. And we've got three main competitors, Sikorsky, who is teamed up with PZL Mielec, his Polish subsidiary, Eurocopter, and Augusta Westland with PZL Świdnik. So the two guys which have Polish companies are looking much better than Eurocopter.
And Christoph, what aircraft, what helicopters are they looking to supply those suppliers?
Well, the 48 are going to go to the army, so a bit like transport helicopters. 10 are going to the Air Force, and they will be combat SAR helicopters.
Right, okay.
And 6 are just SAR helicopters, and 6 more anti-submarine helicopters.
And also the Air Force is looking to upgrade with a new leading fighter trainer. What aircraft are they thinking about there?
Well, the situation is really serious in here because we are using the TS-11 Iskra, which is very, very old. And it doesn't fit for today's standards. So the three main competitors are M-346 Master, Hawk Advanced Jet Trainer, and T-50 Golden Eagle. There was also L-159 from the Czech Aviation, but they have decided to not to participate in this tender. And they left a quite harsh reply. Why did they decided to leave the Polish competition? You can read it on their website.
Right, okay. What does it say? Can you tell us?
Well,
can you tell us a summary?
Yes. Well, they wrote that the rules in the competition aren't fair, and then they do not fit into modern standards. So this doesn't look good for the Polish Air Force from their perspective.
Yeah. Okay. But there's some other big companies in there looking to win this battle. How many aircraft are they looking to supply?
Well, the problem is a bit bigger, you know, because at the first tender, which was cancelled, the aircraft should be combat and training. So they were supposed to change the Su-22 in their missions, but now they are just training. So I don't know, about a dozen, maybe more, that will be sufficient for Poland.
Okay, so let's look at the civilian side. LOT is the main airline in Poland, of course, always has been the, I suppose we would call it the legacy airline. I can remember 20, 30 years ago seeing some of the old Soviet-built aircraft coming into London. But it's a very different situation now, and they're facing a restructuring. What's going on?
Well, the problem is money, as usual. Well, the European Union doesn't like when governments supply money for companies, which is, from obvious reasons, bad for competition on the aviation market. And Poland had to put some huge money into LOT just to make them work. The new Dreamliner was supposed to help in fixing the situation. Now they've got the new management team, which made some restructuring from inside. There are first signs that things are going to look better, but the road is long and bumpy, I would say.
Do you think they'll survive? I mean, there's a lot of competition now, isn't there?
Well, it could be better for them if Boeing would pay them the money for the delays of Dreamliner and the hiccups which they had last time. Yeah. I think that they could manage it if they stick to the plan and work hard. It's not impossible.
Right, okay. Well, that's something we'll maybe come back to in a future episode, and we can maybe look at that in a little bit more detail. But the difficulties for aviation in Poland continues with the development of a new airport at Berlin, and this looks like it's going to put pressure on some of the Polish airports.
Well, if I would live in Szczecin, for example, and or even in Poznań, my hometown, I would consider going straight to Berlin with the motorway and start from there. So especially Szczecin could have huge problems, because such a big airport as Berlin could draw many flyers, many users from the airport. Yeah. And I do not see much movement here in Poznań to gather new directions, new operators, and so it could be difficult.
Very challenging times. And Krzysztof, just before we go, what's your view of the state of aviation in Poland?
Well, the crash of all the experts, you probably heard about it, didn't help Polish aviation.
Yeah.
They were looking very bright when they started their flights. We got the feeling that we could move with an airplane through Poland, but now Eurolot is trying to jump the ship and cover some aspects, LOT also, but there are not so many regional flights as they were previously. But let's hope that things will get better.
Yes, okay. Well, if you want to know anything about aviation in Poland, military, civilian, and some really in-depth analysis, your website is a great place to start. Can you give us the details of where we can find you online?
Well, our address is infolotnicze.pl. We've got a special English section. You will find it on the homepage. We also got our channels on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
Right. Krzysztof, we'll put links to those in the show notes. Thank you very much for joining us on hopefully what is our first of many reviews of Polish aviation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, thanks, Peter. And as he mentions, we'll put links to all of the sites where you can find Christoph's work on the AirplaneGeeks.com website. The shortcut, just look for AirplaneGeeks.com/276, this being episode 276. And, you know, I think it's always interesting to learn a little bit about aviation in other countries. You know, it's just kind of nice to look around the world and see what the issues are and what's going on in other locations.
And Peter, thanks for another excellent find.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, Peter's good at finding interesting guests to talk to.
Well, and think of the challenges that he has, because, you know, for us and even for Stephen Grant, I mean, most of the people we're talking to speak English pretty darn well. And he's in the middle of an area where there are probably 50 languages within, you know, 800 miles. And it's no small challenge.
All right, let's move on to some listener mail. And we'll start off with Tim. We talked about Tim last week and only had a chance to go over a little bit of the items that he had in his email. So he's got some good things, some good points, and I thought it'd be good to, you know, go back to Tim's email and sort of catch up on the rest of the things before we talk about some of the others. And you may recall Tim was the guy where he and his wife had gone to Innsbruck earlier this year and had sort of walked into a little air show in operation there as a, sort of a surprise, a very nice surprise, I have to say. That's great. Arrive at your destination and walk right into an air show. Doesn't get much better than that. He mentioned that the Innsbruck Airport has, he says, the best baggage handling that he's ever seen. He said, we had a very short wait to get through customs and our bags were already waiting for us on the belt. So he'd like to give a shout out to the airport and the staff there. He said it's definitely one of his favorites. But he also says Innsbruck Airport is known for having a difficult approach. And he says, I wonder if any of your listeners may have further information. It would be interesting to hear from a pilot who flies into Innsbruck or other difficult approach airports. Perhaps it could be a topic for discussion. And I was going to ask Rob and Max, do you guys have some particular airports that come to mind as being especially difficult?
Oh, I've certainly got one here, Max West. I was quite surprised when I read an article recently in AOPA that talked about the 10 most difficult airports in America. And they started the list with one here in Northern California. Actually, didn't make the list. They said that this airport is, you know, so tough that we understand mostly only helicopters land here. And I thought, well, that's great. I landed a twin-engine Seneca in there, and if I'd only known that it was only suitable for helicopters, I wouldn't have gone into it.
Yeah, for
but
sure.
It's Happy Camp, which is way up in Northern California at the bottom of mountains that probably run up 7,000-8,000 feet, and there's a river valley that runs through it. And the local gentleman I was coming to pick up for an Angel flight said, you know, just follow the river. You won't be able to see the airport until the last minute, and when you do, you know, just kind of turn to land. And it's a one-way airport. And it's, you know, quite challenging. So I have no plans to go back there.
How about you, Rob? Anything notable?
Well, it's funny that he mentioned it because I'm almost positive I saw a video up on. In fact, if you go up to YouTube and you Google you know, difficult airports or something like that, you'll get a bunch of these. You'll get the people going into the old Shanghai airport, and you'll get. I believe a video of some that people have shot going into Innsbruck. There's an island off the coast of Spain. I can't think of, or of Portugal. I can't think of the name of that one. There's a great approach video going into Cusco. Where's Cusco? Is that Peru? No.
Yes.
It is Peru. Okay. Thank you, David. My geography brain failed me for a minute, but.
And folks, that's how pilots land in the wrong airport.
There you go.
Wondering what? Let's see. Now, what country is that again? No, but actually, and what has often happened is that there'll be somebody sitting in a jump seat with a video camera on, and you get to watch these people make these approaches. Some are visual, some are breaking out of the clouds at all kinds of altitudes, and that really brings home some of how scary some of these approaches are. And that's why we normally do them in the clouds, because if you're in the clouds and you can't see the rocks, you don't get scared. It's only when you're visual that you get scared, because you see how close you are. So
yeah, that's why you recommend flying at night in the mountains in heavy weather, right?
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to mention one other quick thing that Tim mentioned in his email. Are you coming on to this part about Douglas Bader? Were you going to mention that? Or?
Oh, go ahead, Rob.
Well, he mentions Douglas Bader, who was a World War II ace in Britain, and he's written a couple of books. And Tim mentioned these U.S. Air Force bases at Bentwaters and Woodbridge, where there were B-17s. And, of course, I spent a lot of time at the third of the triad of those airports. So there was Bentwaters, Woodbridge, and Wethersfield. And so I'm wondering if maybe Tim knows. I don't think I ever did know whether we had B-17s at Wethersfield long before the U.S. Air Force got there. But so maybe we'll find that out from Tim. So send us another note, Tim.
I'm pretty sure Wethersfield was a B-24 base.
Oh, you think so? Oh. Okay. Well, Tim, can you tell us if David's correct on that next time when we talk to you? I'm just pulling your leg, David.
Well, it's interesting that you say pulling legs when you talk about Douglas Bader. Because Douglas Bader did not had a pair of two wooden legs that he flew Spitfires with. Dog Breath, as he was called, was arrogant enough and also was a wing commander that his Spitfire was D Roundel B for DOB, so that any of the German pilots knew if they saw the flash and the letters on the side of the airplane, they knew they were flying against one of Britain's greatest aces in the Spitfire, Douglas Bader. Now, the only reason why I know this is I'm looking across my room and there's a Spitfire Mark II with the words DOB on the side of it. So, but yes, Douglas Bader is one of my favorite RAF pilots in World War II. Truly an ace of aces.
Wow.
Tim also mentioned that he was fortunate to meet a U.S. Air Force A-10 pilot named Jeff, whose family, he says, moved in just two doors down. He says, I got to know Jeff and his son Jason, and we built model aircraft and rockets. Jeff and the A-10s were instrumental in fueling my interest in aviation, and I will be forever grateful. He says after the Woodbridge base closed in 92, Jeff's family moved on, but he says, I recently got back in touch. And after retiring from the Air Force, Jeff has been flying for Southwest Airlines, or had been flying for Southwest Airlines until his retirement flight on August 1st of this year, 2013. So that's interesting. And that kind of goes back, Max, to what you were saying before about how sometimes, one person can have a big influence on another person's interest in aviation, maybe to the point of motivating them to work towards their pilot's license or maybe some other aspect of aviation. But it doesn't take much to get another person hooked on aviation.
Well, I think some of the studies show that a very large percentage of the public are very hooked on aviation anyway, and it's just a matter of trying to get them into the cockpit. I can't remember if I read something like 50% of the people would love to learn to fly. It's an incredible number.
Wow. Huh.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there are a lot of people that will go out of their way to tell you that, well, it's too expensive, or it's too hard, or it'll take too long, or God help you if you wanted to be a career aviator. Oh, there's no money in it. You'll waste a lot of naysayers, but I don't think you'll find a whole lot of them here at the Airplane Geeks.
All right. We also received an email from Mark Newton. This is a link to an article. TSA officer killed at LAX shooting, bled for 33 minutes before receiving help. This article talks about the fact that we had this recent shooting, right, where some guy goes into L.A. Airport and starts shooting, and the TSA officer was killed. Well, this report says that he was left there. Well, maybe not left there, but the first responders, the medical folks coming to his aid were not allowed to get to him for something like a half an hour. And it's not clear, I guess, if this is as a result of lack of coordination between different agencies or just bad procedures or something else. But that's kind of a terrible situation. And I guess we don't know really if that TSA officer might have survived if he had been tended to more quickly. But I don't know. Doesn't it sound like maybe we need to take a look at how situations like this are handled?
I think this is such a fluke. I'm not saying that, you know, we didn't lose a good airport TSA employee, but I mean, this kind of thing is not exactly running rampant with people going through the airport shooting things up. That I really wanted to take exception to what Mark said here about the fact that it adds to the general degree of incompetence surrounding security operations at airports. I say baloney. And the reason I say that is that if you go up to the TSA website, and let's be serious, none of us like the TSA. We all think that they're kind of goofy and they made our life difficult when it's traveling time. But I actually do think they're getting better. And I also think that people need to be aware of just how many handguns TSA grabs from people at major airports every single week. I believe the record is about 40 in 1 week. And we're talking about people that walk through an airport, go up to security and say, "Oh, completely forgot I had that loaded 357 in my backpack or in my briefcase or whatever." Of course, they call the local law enforcement and have them, you know, they take them away. But I mean, it's not exactly like, the TSA can do a whole lot about somebody that walks into an airport with a loaded rifle at their side and just starts shooting. It's just hard to protect everybody all the time from everything. But again, going back to the story, what the contacts that I talked to said was that they aren't sure, as you said, Max, about what, you know, it was a jurisdictional issue or were they just not sure the area was secure or what. But they're also saying that they believe that this TSA agent was already deceased at the time. And that, you know, getting to him wouldn't have made any difference. At least that's the story I'm hearing.
And I don't really think there's any completely foolproof procedure, you know, that could be written to handle situations like this. I mean, and I'm not saying this is what happened in this case, certainly at all. But, you know, there could be a situation where the first responders coming in with all their medical gear, those could be more terrorists who are actually bringing in more bombs, you know. And so if the idea is that, no, we're not letting anybody here unless they're screened for those kinds of things, I mean, I could see that happening, but it's hard to second guess the situation.
Absolutely it is. And I, you know, you can't regulate everything because it doesn't matter what kind of a regulation you come up with or a procedure. If somebody wants to get to somebody badly enough, and this fellow that shot up the concourse there at LAX obviously had some kind of a vendetta about TSA people. I mean, they're going to look for a weakness and they're going to find it.
Hmm. And I think this guy did find it because it wasn't obvious to me in the past that you could walk in the front door and, you know, wreck mayhem with a gun. But think about it. You know, the security doesn't occur until you're well inside the airport. It made me wonder at the time, are they going to look at moving, you know, all that security back to the front door and just make the entire terminal a secure area?
Well, and think about that. That's a good point, Max. Now, and what if they did? Does that mean that this guy wouldn't have gotten out curbside in some situation with a gun and taking somebody out on the street?
Exactly. You move the line to the outside, yeah, where the people are still exposed. It's true.
Because we've changed a lot. I mean, back in the old days, you look back in the early 70s, the security line used to be right by the gate. I mean, you could almost get up to the gate before you ran out to the airplane with a handgun and no one would know about it. And so we've progressively tried to move these security points further and further and further from the airplanes. But again, I don't think we can protect everybody from everything.
No, unfortunately. Andrew wrote in on the topic of hand flying the airplane to maintain proficiency. And Captain Jeff, when he was on, and certainly on his show, on his podcast, Airline Pilot Guy, has been talking a lot about the necessity of pilots, or the necessity for pilots, to maintain sort of their basic skills by hand flying the airplane, meaning that that you don't rely on automation all the time, or most of the time. Sometimes you just need to be ready for something that can happen. And then if you are overly reliant on automation, which is a great tool, but if you're overly reliant on it, then you sort of can lose some basic proficiency.
Did you say that the FAA came out with a 277-page report this week on just that topic?
They did.
Yeah, it was announced, I think the Wall Street Journal had an article about a week ago that said the report was due out this week. And basically, the whole study said that pilots rely too much on automated systems and may be reluctant to intervene and switch them off when they run into unusual or risky circumstances. And I see this all the time in the glass cockpit GA airplanes that I train in. You know, people either are not as proficient as they need to be in the automation or in the hand flying, or for sure when things go wrong with the automation, they leave the automation on for far too long trying to fix it rather than just switching it off and hand flying the airplane out of the situation.
What do you think is the path to a solution here? I mean, is it just implore pilots to hand fly the airplane more often just because they should, or is there something stronger that needs to be done?
I sometimes wonder if the automation would be a little simpler if Apple was in charge of avionics.
I say that
quite seriously. You know, we've got hundreds of millions of people that can use little computers in their hand, and yet we've got systems in aircraft that befuddle very smart pilots who spend their entire career working on them. And I think there's a huge user interface issue that just hasn't been addressed yet.
Now that's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, because I don't know, I imagine that there are hordes of engineers designing these things, and that's a sort of different skill set than human interface and that sort of thing.
Well, and keep in mind, imagine the iPhones, if we use those as an example. My first iPhone, which was a 3, I thought it was just cool as all get out that it did all these various and sundry things by touch, and it was wonderful. And each successive a generation of the iPhone does more, and the whole phone is just more complex than the earlier version. I'm not necessarily saying it's bad because I love it, but if you don't play with it a lot, it can be a little challenging to operate.
Yep.
And there are times, and I haven't finished the entire report yet, but people are starting to say that is the technology getting ahead, that we are improving and changing and altering because we can rather than because we should. What's the value of having a system that is so complex that the pilots, just like your laptop, you know how to do six or seven things with it, but you keep doing those same six or seven things over years and years and years, but it doesn't mean you know all about the other 86 things it'll actually do because you don't really play with them very often. And if you need them, you can be in a real corner. Or if the whole computer shuts down, you go, now what do I do?
Yeah, the thing that really scares me, and I see this far more than I wish I did, is people who just start punching away madly at the buttons, like they're punching keys on a typewriter, hoping that they'll get the right sentence to come out. And it's just amazing how people won't stop and think about, okay, what function is it I'm trying to perform? What button do I need to push? If something goes wrong, they look like just hens pecking away at corn. it's really kind of scary. Somehow the brain goes out the window, and they do whatever it takes to try and fix it by just punching madly at buttons.
That's right. And what they're not doing is they're not flying the airplane while their head is down trying to figure out how to run the computer. And the worst situation, even in a two-man cockpit, is when you end up with both pilots heads down trying to figure out some piece of the automation that they thought they understood that they don't. And nobody's looking out the windows. So I'm sorry, David, you were going to say something.
Is there a mentality for the designers of the software that it has to be complex. These are pilots. They understand complex systems. That they don't have the same mentality that they would if they were programming for the general public and say, okay, we have to program this for the lowest denominator. Are they expecting too much from the aviators? I mean, as far as when it comes to these systems?
Yeah, possibly. I think that there's a lot more book study and book work that's required that wasn't required in the past, and there may be some aviators that, you know, think they can get by with the same level of study that they did in the past, and it's just not the case.
Should they be programming those systems to be not so? I don't know. It seems like my friend is a computer programmer, and his biggest pet peeve of all time is every time Microsoft goes to a new number, they inevitably change the user interface so that when I go to Microsoft Word 97 from or 2007 to 2011, I spend like 5 weeks trying to find all the functions in Excel and Word that I used to know where they were, but now they've moved them to some other hidden corner.
But it's better, David. It's better.
Yeah, it might be better, but I would love a button that says I could go back to that other user face, because now you're making me relearn something that I really shouldn't have to relearn. If the electronics on airplanes are the same thing, I can understand why pilots are putting and pecking at things when things go wrong.
I think the UI changes a lot less in airplanes simply because there are fewer touch screens. It's a lot harder to change the functions and software because you've got, you know, physical buttons, and, you know, buttons don't change but every, you know, 10 years or whatever the generation, you know, becomes of the next iteration. So it's almost we have the opposite problem. We don't change the UI much, and it's still hard to understand.
Well, and one other thing I think I was going to mention when we were talking about, you know, what's the solution is to get pilots to simply go back to fly by hand. Remember when we had Christine Negroni on a week or two ago, and we talked about that same subject, and she said, no, you know, and she really took me to task because I was indicating pilots need to fly more. But she made a really interesting point that a lot of new pilots that are learning to fly in recent years, especially some of those coming up in Europe where there's a multi-pilot system and all they know is an automated airplane almost from the get-go, and they don't have some of those same basics to fall back on, and that's a problem that we have not really addressed. Has training kept up with the state of automation? I don't know. I mean, I know when I was flying charter, we had GPS equipment in the airplanes, and they'd say, well, you know, you're going to go fly with Don today. He's going to kind of show you how to work that thing, and, you know, you just kind of go, and how do I load an approach? Okay, now I got it, you know. But, I mean, did I really understand all the rest of what it did? No, because we were too busy. We didn't have time to train. And and so sometimes that's what people think is, well, I'll read the book and I'll get it, and then it'll all make sense. And you can't read the book and then practice in the airplane while you're flying. You can't do that. It just doesn't work. You're too busy.
And you used to be able to, and I don't think the mindset has changed in aviation that there has been a large shift like that, because in the old days, that's how it got done. And to the hand-flying thing, I think there's a bigger issue for folks overseas than there is here in the U.S. Here in the U.S., any pilot who's really interested in flying in GA can go do that on weekends. You go to many of these countries, if not most of them, there is no opportunity for someone who got their license in the United States, put their 250 hours into Piper Archer or whatever it was. Now they're put in the right seat of a 737 in whatever their new home country is, and they never get in a small airplane again. They never have an opportunity to fly by hand except for that first 30 seconds on takeoff, and, you know, maybe not at all on landing. You know, on landing, a 777, you're supposed to leave the auto throttles on to touchdown. And there's a lot of that stuff that's so automated, they don't have the capability to hand fly again at all.
Does the pilot industry have recurrent training? Unfortunately, I have licenses. I hardly ever use them, but they're insurance licenses. And every 2 years, I have to sit through recurrent training, 24 credits worth. Is there a standard that maybe pilots need to follow, that they need to have that recurrent training every 24 months?
Oh, sure they have recurrent training. I mean, most of the professional crews will train in a simulator at least annually, some of them more often than that. But one of the criticisms that has been labeled is they don't spend enough time on the technology, that they teach them how to use certain bits of it in certain situations to get through what they need to in order to meet the criteria for the FAA. Now, whether they actually understood what they were doing in some situations, it's not always clear. And nobody wants to spend more time in recurrent training because it's expensive. Well, guess how expensive an accident is.
Well, I mean, so in other words, like every other industry, the aviation industry is training to minimums.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, they really are. I'm not saying all of them. I'm sure there are some that go above and beyond, but not many, I bet.
All right, let's see if we can move pretty quickly. And we had some links, some interesting links that listeners sent in. We can mention these, and we'll put these all in the show notes. Our main man, Micah, sent in a link to a Boston Herald article, Logan Runway Gets Debris Detectors. And this is about a FOD system, foreign object debris, sometimes called foreign object damage, if you're looking at it from the engine OEM standpoint. But this company, X-Site Systems, has an automated FOD detection system that's sort of set up to be co-located with runway edge lights. And this thing is supposed to detect when there's junk on the runway. Is this a big problem?
Coming from the base civil engineer side of my life, that FOD would be moving large, usually with 10 points on their head, i.e. deer.
Yeah.
Well, and that's kind of a cool system, though. I mean, is that now they have the additional set of electronic eyeballs to watch for junk on the runway. It said it'll detect something as small as a bolt laying on the runway.
Wow.
And so, of course, we're talking about technology. Hey, this is pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
And this is pretty useful. And but again, it doesn't require someone to be operating it while they are driving or anything like that. It can all be done remotely from a desktop.
It's got to be a good deal. You look at the number of airports now which send a truck down the runway every few hours, and those guys can't spot a bolt, I'm sure.
So it'd be interesting to watch how Logan Airport in Boston makes out with this new system.
Oh, well, it's already installed. It's been tested. Yeah, they added it to runway 927 last week, and it's built by an Israeli company, and they tested it for quite a while at Tel Aviv. So apparently it's had some pretty interesting results.
Okay.
Oh, that makes perfect sense if it's an Israeli product.
Okay.
Well, no,
I'm afraid
seriously,
to ask why.
It's to prevent things like rockets and bombs and other terrorist activities that would occur on a runway at Ben Gurion Airport. It makes it perfect. It's just another level of security for the Israelis. So, I mean, that would make perfect sense why they would, all they need is some terrorists to try to get something on the runway at Ben Gurion as a low cost way to wreak havoc on the airport. So, I mean, I've seen what deer do to 130s. I can imagine what something does to a fully loaded 747 coming in. So it makes perfect sense that it would be an Israeli designed product.
Jason sent in a link. He said a friend of his who's a relatively newly minted Osprey pilot with his squadron produced a video as part of that squadron's celebration of the U.S. Marine Corps' birthday. And this is titled VM-161, The Greyhawks, 62 Years of Assault Support History. And it's a little video on Vimeo, which is, I think, really well done. It's seems to be professionally done, and is a great thing to watch. So we'll put that link in the show notes. We heard from Paul Filmer. Last week we were ragging on Russian-built airplanes and airlines, and we talked about the fact that none of us really ever wanted to fly on a Russian airline or a Russian-built aircraft. And Paul takes issue with that. He says, yes, they have a worse than normal record, but many of the airfields they use are remote and rugged with little instrumentation due to the country being so large. He says, stick to normal routes and you're fine, as I do, as a matter of course. And then he says, I'd rather be in an older, over-engineered, Russian-built airframe than a plastic pig. So thanks. Thanks to Paul for that.
Not me, baby.
Yeah, I'm still... Paul, you go right ahead. Now, Paul, of course, is one of the better aviation photographers around. And if you haven't been to his website, skippyscage.com, go do that and you will find a treat. And hopefully Paul will minimize his flight on Russian Airlines and be around long enough to produce a lot more great photography for us to look at. Sven sent us an article from, this is a CNN article, China Gets Ready for Takeoff, talking about China's efforts to become a major player in aviation as a manufacturer. And he talks about the Comac C919, which is intended to be a competitor to, it's roughly Airbus A320, Boeing 737 size. The Chinese have had some difficulties kind of getting up to speed. They have also been working on a small regional jet for years, the ARJ-21, and they just haven't been able to get that together and built and out there. And at the same time, now they're also working on the larger Comac plane. It's always worth trying to keep a current view of what's going on in China, because while they may not be that big in a global sense right now, I think it's only a matter of time. David sent us an article, Multi-Rotor Volocopter, A Revolution in Aviation. This is kind of interesting. This is the VC-200 from a company called eVolo. And David, what does this craft remind you of?
Can I say it?
Yep.
On the show?
Sure, go ahead, do it.
It's a multicopter.
It is.
It's like all of our fun toy drones that we like talking about so much on that other show we do.
Except really big. It's got 18 electric motors powering a rotor. It's a two-seater. This is a craft that you get in physically. It holds two people. It says it'll go up to an altitude of 6,500 feet. Interesting. There's a video there that you can look at. I think this thing has a gigantic diameter, and so that might sort of impact the practicality of it, but it's great to see somebody trying something like this. It's different.
It's electric motors, too. We need to make sure that everybody... So it's running on batteries, and at one scene, it's actually being flown NOLA with no live operator, and it's just being flown by a remote control thing, so
right.
A box. So it's one of those cool, should be on both shows kind of stuff. Oh, and David Martin, David, who sent it to us, I love the name. That's why the M is in Vanderhoof. So,
oh, is that right?
I was very happy to see that David Martin wrote into the show that features David Martin.
We also heard again from Mark Newton. We were talking about airplanes with folding wings. We started talking about the 777X and how that's going to have folding wings. And we weren't aware of too many others that did that. And since we said that, lots of listeners have written in with other examples. Mark writes in about the STEMI, I guess you would pronounce it, S-10. That comes with folding wings. It's a sailplane produced in Germany for over 30 years now, I guess. Thanks for Mark for pointing that out. And then finally, Micah again sent us an email with a link to an article about an airplane that landed on the interstate in Maine during rush hour. This was a Cessna 152 and ran into engine problems. And he didn't make it to the airport, and so he landed on the highway and sort of miraculously didn't hit anybody, and I don't think anybody hit him.
Talk about merging into traffic.
Is there any rule about landing on a public road when you're in an emergency situation?
Boy, I think the only rule is don't make the situation worse by injuring somebody else.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's just why take your misery and share it with other people? Yeah, I think people have to be really, really, really careful. We had an accident here in the San Francisco Bay Area, oh, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, where a plane landed and the propeller chopped into an automobile, and somebody's legs were, you know, damaged because of that. So it's just, you got to be careful.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest this episode, Max Trescott. Max, tell our listeners all the places where they can find you online.
Oh, you can find my business site at g1000book.com, and my blog is at maxtrescott.com.
Very good. Thank you. We also want to thank our contributors, Graham McCarron and Steve Vischer from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, and Peter Johnson from Aviation Extended podcast. So let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, they can find us on Twitter at JetWine. They can find us on the blog at JetWine.com, and places on Facebook and LinkedIn and all that. And you know, just to echo something that David said a little while ago about being thankful for people, and I just really want to take a moment and kind of mend some fences here and tell Stephen Grant how grateful I am that they're around. And I know I pick on them kind of relentlessly, and I'm just thankful that they're there, because I don't know who I pick on anymore if Dan's not around.
Okay. All right. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
Recently sitting in front of the television watching Doctor Who, but
apparently.
More to the point, you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Google+. And, of course, all of our Airplane Geeks websites. I'm always lurking there, catching up on all the reading, because we've got such fantastic listeners that give us a lot to read. And especially when you have days when suddenly Max is catching up on emails, and Rob and I have 30 emails that we suddenly have to read. But from the bottom of my heart, I wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving. Even if you don't celebrate it, know that we are very thankful for all of you, what you do. And we do realize that you give us 2 hours a week of your life. That's very important to listen to us. So thank you very much.
Very good, David. Thank you. And I'm Max Flight. These days, mostly you can find me on Google+ and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight. And also with David at theuavdigest.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 276. You'll find links to all the sites that we mentioned in the podcast, also some listener comments. You can even buy some Airplane Geeks t-shirts. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, all those places, as David mentioned. Also, stitcher.com. You can stream us right to your mobile phone or other device. Also, find us on tunein.com. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, oh, look who just showed up.
Please, the Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Binet, the aviation queen. Send us a voicemail by calling that number. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Happy
Thanks for listening.
Oh, you're probably right. Well, maybe David's got something to say then.
David.
Come off mute.
It's your chance. David.
He's left.
He's gone.
He's gone. Do you speak any other languages, Rob?
I'm actually learning a little French, because my daughter is pretty good, and she's shamed me into doing it. Actually, I kind of wanted to do it anyway, so.
Well, good. Well, you get proficient in that, and we can get some French-speaking guests on the show.
Let's be honest. The only reason why he's learning French is he's bucking for another A380 ride or a Dassault Falcon ride.
There you go.
Or I want to be able to converse with all the ladies in Paris next time I go.
Ah, at the air show.
I'm sure the madame of the household will not appreciate that.
Well, I didn't say I was going to tell her about it. Okay. Guys, jeez.